Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Penske Podcast. If you haven't tuned in before, this is a podcast where we are running through all 178 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, giving our thoughts and feelings about each and every one. Right now we're up to episode 12 of season 6. It's called Ship in a Bottle, directed by Alexander Singer, written by Rene Echevarria, and aired back on January 24th, 1993. I'm sorry, everyone. People always give me a hard time about pronouncing Rene's last name, and I can't do it, so that's the best you're going to get. Anyway, Ship in a Bottle is the episode where the sentient holodeck character, Professor James Moriarty, puts the Enterprise in jeopardy in its quest to be free to live outside the confines of the holodeck. And Tan and Sean are here to talk about this one. Continuing our discussion about sentience and life forms that we had from Quality of Life, we're going to be talking about Ship in a Bottle right after this.
Although objects appear solid on the holodeck, in the real world, they have no substance. An object has no life. I do. Professor, you are a computer simulation. I have consciousness. Conscious beings have will. The mind endows them with powers that are not necessarily understood, even by you. If my will is strong enough, perhaps I can exist outside this room. Perhaps I can walk into your world right now. Professor, I ask you to believe me. If you step out of that door, you will cease to exist. If I am nothing more than a computer simulation, then very little will have been lost. But if I am right, mind over matter.
Well, a couple of episodes ago, we had an argument about, not an argument, I guess, because no one, I don't know what people are arguing against me. Although, Sean, you claim that you don't believe my talk of what sentience is. So now we're going to talk about yet another TNG episode that has to deal with sentience of something. We're bringing back Moriarty in Ship in a Bottle. Tan and Sean, how are you? Thank you for coming back on.
Doing great.
Excellent.
I love this podcast. I'm happy to be here. I can't wait to talk about sentience. I like it because I am sentient.
That's exactly right. So a lobster wouldn't like this episode because he would not know what the fuck he was talking about.
And a lobster is not sentient.
That's wait, right. No. Exactly.
No, wait. Fuck, I screwed up already.
Yeah. I win. Podcast is over. Anyway.
The definition of sentient is able to perceive or feel things.
Right.
From having just looked it up.
But is that what the definition?
So lobster is able to perceive or feel that you're boiling it alive, so it's sentient.
Right. So would a mosquito, though. I mean, yeah. There's no, we don't know what the actual answer is, I feel. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know what Wes was saying, but technically speaking, lobsters are sentient.
Yep. This is going to be such a fun discussion.
Wes?
Sure. So... Well, So I guess we'll start it by talking about the episode here. So Moriarty, right? I guess we'll do a little bit of backstory here. Moriarty is a season 2 callback that they've waited a very long time to bring back because there was some copyright brouhaha with the estate of Sherlock Holmes, or the actual author as opposed to a fictional character. So they finally bring him back. And he was created in season 2 as a yet another thing to go against the Quality of Life episode that we just talked about, where Data asked the computer to create a nemesis for himself in the holodeck that would be able to compete with Data as opposed to Sherlock Holmes. So the holodeck created Moriarty. And he was beaten, or not beaten, but he agreed to just go into like sort of hiding, or not hiding, but he agreed to be locked away in the holodeck computer. And at some point in the future, the crew would bring him back once they were able to allow him to exist outside the holodeck. Well, he's back, and he's in Ship in a Bottle. What'd you guys think of this episode in general?
Sean?
Oh, this is one of my top 10, probably. I love the acting. I love the guy who plays Moriarty. I like, what's his name? The bumbling guy from on the crew.
Mm-hmm. Barclay.
Barclay, thank you. I love Barclay. And even like the woman who was Moriarty's love interest, I felt she went toe-to-toe with Picard pretty well. I mean, all around amazing, and I think it holds up on second and third viewings because you start catching things as you see it again and again.
Sure.
I am so surprised that you love this. I would have skipped this episode after the opening scene, Sean.
Oh,
I'm so
man.
sorry.
This is not
So
RoboCop.
sorry.
Is it
This
where
is
they're
not
watching
RoboCop.
RoboCop on the viewer? It's what's the opening scene?
Maybe you'll be able to persuade me that it's not garbage.
Oh,
Hopefully.
well, I'll say with Sean, I think this episode is very, very strong. I don't know if it's a top 10, but I think it has a lot of things going for it. So let's start, I guess, with the why do you think it's not a particularly good episode?
The premise of it requires too many leaps of faith. It's the RoboCop principle. Like, I can believe it to a certain point, but there are just too many holes. There's too many things I have to somehow take for granted that they've overlooked, and I find that really distracting, and it negatively impacts my enjoyment of the episode.
The writers or the cast members are overlooking it.
The writers, the actual layout, for example. Okay, so, or we could talk about it maybe after you set up the,
Well,
like,
sure.
what
I mean,
happens.
so let's. I'll compare it to Quality of Life by
Okay.
starting off, which is the episode we watched a couple of things ago, the Exocomp one, where the Exocomps are determined to be sentient creatures who deserve to be recognized as life forms. Where I thought that Quality of Life had no idea what it was trying to talk about, I think that they approach like what is a life form much better in this one. And that argument is coupled with a kind of a neat narrative structure to this episode that I think rewards repeat viewings. Once you know what's real in the second half of the episode and what isn't, it makes the performances interesting to me. And the writing, because the writers in the second half avoid using characters who aren't Picard, Data, and Barclay. They only give very curt answers to things. And I think that's kind of a fascinating writer technique that they chose to do. So I'm interested in what you had a big because I have a bigger time, a harder time buying into the exocomp argument that they're alive than I do Moriarty being a creature.
Well, okay, so there's the idea that the holodeck computer is capable of creating life simply because in season two, Geordi misspeaks and says, let's get a nemesis that can beat Data. And suddenly the computer has the ability to create that character. So I think that that's already an overpowered situation. But even if we're going to talk about when Barclay, Picard, and Data get trapped inside the holodeck, there are physical limitations to where the three of them can be. At one point, you remember when Data discovers that they are, is it Data? Yeah, that he discovers that they're in the holodeck. And he needs to make a point that they're in there. He can touch the walls, right? But where's Barclay? Like, Barclay has to physically be in that space, and he's not in that scene, and he's nowhere.
They've shown that to be the case before, that
Right?
people on the holodeck can be separated from each other.
And I know that that's a thing that they've done. They did it in the first Moriarty episode, and they've done it in, like, the Wild West one. They've done it a bunch of different times where people are just a long distance apart, but that's one of the things. There's also the scene, Sean, where Picard is talking to the girlfriend, right? Where is Moriarty? This is Moriarty's program, right? He shouldn't Moriarty be omniscient in this holodeck program. He wrote it, and at
But
this
he can't.
time, he is still a sequence of ones and zeros. And so
Right, I
he
agree.
should be aware of everything that's happening. There should be no possibility of subterfuge inside the program for Picard and Data to pull off, against Moriarty. And I think it's clever on a human level that Picard is talking to the girlfriend and is saying, don't tell him, and this is what we're going to do. And, I think that there's a, like, the story behind that is good, but the mechanics of it are what take me out of the story. And
Well,
I think,
I guess, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, I guess,
no,
but
that was it.
it's the problem is that Picard, when he's talking to her, is playing her. So even if she was Moriarty, he's tricking, 'cause she is naturally suspicious because I guess Moriarty has given her consciousness like he has.
Right, because somehow this is a thing he's capable of doing. Okay, I don't know how he got it in the first place. In order for me to accept this episode, I have to take, that's another thing that I have to take for granted, that I have to say, okay, and it just keeps extrapolating on an already faulty principle to begin with. And so it's just keeping, it keeps asking me to make those kind of leaps. And for me personally, I find it kind of, I don't know.
Well, why were you able to accept the exocomps becoming self-aware and the holodeck is not possible, I guess would be my counter argument.
Why hasn't the holodeck made other creatures sentient since? Why has nobody examined the possibility of them making Moriarty? Like they say inside the episode. So it just inspires me to pick at all of the loose threads of the episode instead of taking it at face value. And I think if you take it at face value, it can be a very enjoyable episode. But there's too much for me. Like it's, for me, it's just asking too many other questions, and I can't put those questions to the side enough to be able to enjoy the episode for what the episode is.
I understand, and I can see two of your points completely. When Data tells Picard that this is all simulation, they start whispering, and I thought, why are they whispering? Shouldn't Moriarty be everywhere? And that's the same thing as talking to his girlfriend. And the idea of the computer being able to build something more powerful than Data. Yeah, that's a stretch. But for me, those two strikes, I already accepted the holodeck thing is silly, but they just move past it kind of.
It's canon. And, I mean, it's now it's kind of canon, right? If anything, you should have a bigger problem with the first episode where I'll have less of a problem if they just continue with the idea in this episode.
Right. Well, they do. At the beginning, Geordi does go, Barclay, the holodeck is broken again.
Yeah. I appreciated that as a narrative device, bringing in Barclay, a character who's unfamiliar with Moriarty, to have Moriarty do the exposition dump on him.
Yeah.
I thought that was really well done.
Yep. I think the acting in it is really good. I like the idea, the resolution, the whole switcheroo, a world inside a world inside a world. And we had talked about, or we mentioned Rick and Morty before. There's an episode of Rick and Morty that plays with this idea of trapping people in a world inside a world inside a world. But they use the ridiculousness of it to great effect. Whereas I think the seriousness of this episode kind of falls flat for me for whatever reason, whatever collection of reasons, it just doesn't work. But I would love to hear what you guys love about it. Like, bring me over to your side.
Sean?
I think that this episode was really hard for the staff to pull off. I think that usually, like, especially after the last one we spoke about, for them to pull off an episode like this is pretty impressive. I grant Tana the technical hiccups that it has, absolutely. I think that the rest of the plot and the characters and the acting and the writing is so strong that it just doesn't bother me. Especially to write something layered that you, even the viewer, even Barclay at the very end is unsure if the episode is really over yet or what is reality. And I love the ending where they win, but Moriarty doesn't know he's lost because he's forever trapped in an iPod of, you know, infinite memory or whatever. I love how the woman was written. She was empowered. And, you know, even when Barclay was like, oh, I don't really want to explain this to you. And she's like, excuse me, are you telling me I'm incapable of understanding these things? I felt it was such a strong character, such a great line that makes me respect Moriarty too. Like, I forget that he's a bad guy in this. I kind of see exactly what his point is. And I don't blame him for pushing up against Picard like he does, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. I understand what Tana is saying, and those two things, the few things that she mentioned, I kind of skip past it because I'm so in love with a lot of the other stuff that it does so well.
Yeah,
I think I'll say that as someone who appreciates technical stuff and technical, like more technical writing, I think this is one of the best structured, layered scripts that the show has done to this point. There's a lot going on between where people are, like in what reality they're existing in. The double twist at the end is really clever, the way that they get out of it. And I think that this one Has a ton of great guest acting. Barclay, Reginald Schultz is always excellent as Barclay. Daniel Davis, who plays Moriarty, is always strong. The woman who plays the Countess is exceptionally strong. It's rare to get that amount of guest acting that's good on the show at one point, so that's always a positive. And lastly, it's just where, going back to quality of life, I don't need this show to make grand sort of like enlightening, like opening my eyes to some sort of philosophy thing that I've never seen. I just need it to be correct, or like in a sense that it, in a way that it makes sense. And I think that this one handles intelligence and like artificial intelligence in a way that doesn't really, you know, it's not providing huge insight, but it's really clever. And by the end of it, it's also sort of very philosophical about like what, you know, where the, just the sort of breaking the third wall. Picard has this speech about like, maybe we are characters existing in a box in somebody's table. And it's like, I get, that's like very clever to me. And that's as clever as the show has ever been. And I enjoyed that. I love the ending. I think that the ending, like as a totally divorced from the narrative thing, it's one of the strongest endings that the show has ever done.
Yeah, Tana, this is our RoboCop.
This is another RoboCop. I just can't get past like the idea. So for me, the ending where Picard is saying, you know, maybe we are just, that seemed like, what did you guys get that he was saying? You're watching this on TV. I'm breaking the fourth wall.
Definitely,
you know, we're just a world inside another world. Like that kind of wink and nudge was still a little too campy for me. The whole thing just seemed very, like, you know, it just, this episode doesn't do it for me.
Well, I guess we can talk about, I mean, the other philosophical ending there is, I guess they're kind of saying in regards to Moriarty, right, that freedom is just an illusion. Right.
Like,
you're only free as long as you think that you're a puppet is free as long as he loves his strings. You know that expression?
Yep. Right. Let me ask you this, guys. What's more important to save? Something that's alive or something that's just sentient?
And this is a great thing, right? Because he's not actually alive. So he's just a computer program that, you know, is, for whatever reason that we will suspend our disbelief, aware of the fact that he's a computer program and he wants his freedom. And so they write a computer program for him that will grant him happiness and freedom, right? A matrix. They've created a matrix for him to live in.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have in their real universe, their real world, these little robots that float around and learn and have some sort of social structure and self-preservation and are clever and noble and, you know, very good tools that are alive that you seem less to care less about.
Well, here's, I've actually, you guys rudely accused me of not knowing my sentence definition, but here's, I've been looking because I can now, I had to think about it. Sentience, and I'm going to pull this off of something that I Googled quickly. So it has to do, like, when you think about animal rights, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to argue that the exocomps have not been proved to be sentient, where Moriarty has been. So the concept central to the philosophy of animal rights with regards to sentience is you have to be able to suffer for there to be sentience, right? That's experience, perceiving, feeling subjectively.
Okay.
So lesser life forms like clams and lobsters do not have the ability to suffer. Honeybees, if you put a honeybee in a jar, we have no way of telling that this thing is actually subjectively suffering anything. You know, it might, it's just kind of existing. Where animals, as you get bigger, the argument against being cruel to them was that animals are able to become unhappy or be in situations where they feel unhappiness. The exocomps were never able to prove that they were unhappy. They had a sense of self-preservation, where Moriarty is outright coming out and say, I was alone for 4 years suffering. How dare you do this to me?
Okay.
I agree. That's the difference.
And I agree that he is sentient. What you're doing is you're putting the line on what is alive and sentient, and you're saying that small animals like bees are not sentient. But when you get to be bigger like a deer and you can suffer, then you are sentient. And a bee doesn't look like it's suffering doesn't mean, just because we're not able to measure that suffering doesn't mean that it isn't. So I agree with your definition. I guess my personal opinion is I would set the bar differently. So I would say that bugs are sentient in a very small, pathetic way compared to humans, of course. I think they are. A virus, I think, is on the line. A virus, I think, is, you, some would say it's halfway to life because it can't complete itself. It can't reproduce until it lacks, I'm sorry, it locks onto your DNA, adding itself, and then it can be alive. But then it's something else at that point.
Sean, you might be able to make a similar argument for flowers, right? Like a flower can't reproduce, or an apple tree without bees, you know? And so it's alive and it reproduces, but if you eliminate bees from the environment and the, you know, cross-pollination, then the plants will die.
Well, I think this is a little confusing. I'm not, neither, like, the argument we're confusing, I think, again, alive and sentient. Like, the plants are clearly alive.
Right.
They do not have the ability to perceive.
No.
So plants would not be sentient. And, like, you could have a tiny animal be sentient. It's just this sort of, you know, there has to be some sort of neurological design that allows things to be complicated enough to be able to experience subjectivity.
Right, because we can see that a cow behaves differently when it is depressed. We can measure the way it behaves when it's happy and the way it, you know, behaves differently under different stimuli. We can identify that this animal is happy or sad, suffering or not suffering, content, all of these sort of measurable things. And either we lack the ability to measure a bee's contentedness as it starves to death in a jar, or, you know, or the bar, as you said, Sean, is just in a different spot for the three of us.
I don't think there is a definition of this that scientists can agree on. And even Beverly kind of says that. I mean, I hear your arguments, and I kind of agree with, I see where you guys are all coming from completely, but no one really can define where that bar is, what's sentient, what's alive. I mean, that's something that we're still struggling with, you know?
Right. The answer is up for grabs, but I think if you don't come up with a definition, you become extremely morally confused about what you're doing. Like there's no, that would argue that me going outside and stepping on an ant is just as bad as stabbing a cow.
No, I mean, technically ants feel pain, but when a bee is depressed, he's not listening to The Cure and shopping at Hot Topic.
Pain is not suffering. Pain is different. Pain is a neurological response. Suffering is you being able to perceive that there is a better situation than the one I'm currently in.
Huh.
Right, but bees are even. Dogs can have some predictability on the future. Like they can predict what's going to happen. They have some idea of, I don't like feeling this way. Yep. I wish I felt better. And as you go down the food chain, bees might have some of that, but it's so different than ours.
Yes, I think it's different. I think it's I'm not sure how correct it would say that. Like we obviously, there's something about a bee that we can't measure.
Of course.
But it's really just a, you, if you feel that way, you should have a very different reaction to how you treat the various animals. And I think everyone, even the most hardcore vegans, kind of see a difference between that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a very important thing to, like, a difference that we have to identify.
Right.
And that's the difference between, to tie it back to the episode, Moriarty deserves a better fate, and he gets a better fate, although he's ironically in a prison still at the end.
Right. But here's my question. Oh, I wanted to bring this up and see what you guys thought. So if Moriarty is sentient, if he is alive and it, you know, is, we are arguing that he should be treated like a human, what he has just done is a prosecutable offense. He has endangered 1,000 innocent people, taken the Enterprise hostage, right? Mm-hmm. A Federation starship, commandeered it like a common pirate, right? And refused, like a terrorist, and refused to relinquish control until his demands are met.
Yep.
And his reward for that is to get everything he wanted. That is another way to read this episode.
Yeah, that is true. They should have had his shuttlecraft run out of gas or something halfway through. But yeah, it's true that he doesn't really get punished, although they've kind of, I guess it would tie, it's been a very philosophical thing. I guess it ties into your thing of what the point of punishing him would be, where they've eliminated the threat. And in my worldview, eliminating the threat is better than punishment. So him being in the box is like no amount of punishment is going to fix what he did, but just getting rid of him and being like, well, now he's ignorant and happy and he'll be okay over here, I think is appropriate, I guess.
I think it's a fine solution. I think having him in the cube, I wonder if somebody of his vast intelligence and computer will understand or be able to unlock at some point in the future that he is in a world inside a world inside a cube,
Yeah, I
and
almost
get
had a
really
bigger
upset
problem with
about that.
that. Yeah, that's I agree.
Well, so he Russ said that he's in a way he is in a prison, but he is more free than any of us is. He's got a whole universe and a shuttlecraft. You and I are on prison Earth. We cannot escape. And obviously, we live our lives in contentment, and that's
Well,
fine with us.
it'd be the Matrix argument, right? Are you
Totally. It
is
is.
being in the Matrix better than being in reality, sort of like if you can get whatever you want in the Matrix. So he's in his own Matrix. He just doesn't power anything. He needs a huge clunky piece of shit attached to his little prison to power it up.
Will they ever die? Like, are these two ever going to age and die? At some point, they're going to reach the end of this program. So, if you spend any time, examining the ideas, the big ideas that this show is presenting, it all kind of crumbles. He'll reach the end of the program. Like, he just will. And then he'll know he's been trapped inside a program and he'll suffer again.
No, I mean, if it runs out of energy, he'll just expire, just like the cube he's in. And that's kind of, if you want to, I feel like what Picard is sort of suggesting at the end is, well, how are we really any different? Maybe we're inside of a box on someone's table or blah, 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 blah.
And that Elon Musk came out recently with his idea that he thought all of reality is some kind of simulation.
There's
Which
a, there's a. Ooh, this might be a little bit heady, but I'm gonna throw it out there.
Do it.
There's a professor that thinks that mathematically speaking, it's more likely that all of us, everyone listening to the podcast, you and me, there's a better chance that this is not real than it is actually real. Because when you look at the math, we have virtual reality right now, and in 100 years, we'll have way more virtual reality programs than we'll have actually a real life world. And by that point, mathematically speaking, the odds are that you will be in a fake world and you'll just have forgotten.
Yeah, no,
Jesus.
it's I mean I can't
Boom.
agree. There's no way to disprove it. It just results in, we're in our prison of perception as Moriarty is at the end. And you're limited to what you actually can sort of see and understand around you. And I think it's just a very strong thinky episode. I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about not to that was a bad discussion, but just to talk about I think the narrative structure is clever. And I think that what they did in terms of the plot here is interesting. I do agree that there is a problem with Moriarty not being sort of omniscient inside the holodeck. But at that point, it would interfere with what I think is the great turn. And the great turn is awesome because when you go back and watch them, notice how little the people who aren't in the holodeck are doing anything when the other characters are around them.
When they tell Geordi to go take a hike, and
Yeah,
Geordi's
Geordi
like,
just
okay.
walks off. That's my favorite. Would I love that scene because of how you would react. Like there would be that awkward period where you weren't sure if you could ignore Geordi as you're trying to figure out what's going on. And I just like the Picard gives him a couple like over the shoulder like head turns a couple times and then comes back to him. I really love that scene and then he just walks off.
I feel like that was shot without LeVar Burton knowing that they were actually shooting live. I think that's just how they treat
I
LeVar
guess it depends on how much the actors are invested in the entire script. So like if you were filming that, do you have to know that you got, well, Geordi does, but in like the scenes where Riker and Worf are present, I wonder if they knew what they were doing or if that was just kind of, if that's me looking into the performances and seeing something.
Now, wouldn't Geordi be like, wouldn't inside the holodeck Geordi be like, wait a second, guys, so I'm not real? Do we that's
Oh,
it. I'm gonna leave now.
we've determined that the non-Moriarty infused characters on the holodeck don't seem to care.
They're just fill-ins.
When you call
They're
them
just
out on their
straw
shit,
men.
they just shut down.
Yeah,
like Geordi just stops talking. He starts shitting himself. He doesn't know how to breathe. I mean, he just completely shuts down.
Oh my god! In the last episode, when he was yelling again at a female scientist, I was like, "Oh, well, we know this note."
Wait, oh, that reminds me. When so Geordi had a couple of Oh wait, shit! That's the last podcast we did. Never mind.
I know. Well, I meant to bring it up in the last one, and I totally forgot. But yeah, stop screaming at female scientists, Geordi.
Geordi's uncomfortable with the whole situation. Although the female scientists on the show, it seems like every scientist is bringing some bad information, pretty much, and they need to clarify what they're talking about. Let's see, Moriarty. I mean,
so what makes it such a tight like structure? What makes it such a, I don't know, a stylistically.
I think they
good episode.
I think they play the two twists very well, especially the last one, where we reveal that they've created a holodeck inside the holodeck, essentially, that's fooling Moriarty. I just think that it's well played by everybody. Yeah. Like they don't really hint at it, but there are enough clues where when you go back, you're like, oh, that is definitely what's actually happening there.
Right. And even when I rewatch it, knowing what I know, I still have to remind myself, okay, wait, so does Picard know, or is he actually on the ship, or is he in the holodeck?
Yes.
You for even having all the cards, you still forget. At least I do.
Yeah, well, you spend the entire time, you go, okay, now they're going into the holodeck. This is where it's all going to start. You know, you like start to realize things like
And I can see that that's kind of a cool aspect. I need so in order for me to enjoy it, I just need to accept the givens, you know, like if this is a mathematical equation, I just need to accept the givens and work out the puzzle I'm presented with.
Yeah.
So well, if it bugs you, it bugs you. I mean, this stuff that Clay and Wes has liked, and I don't know what they're talking about, but I mean, we all have I was actually going to ask Tana, and this is kind of separate from the subject. So when I did a podcast with Wes last, I realized that I'm a sucker for character moments on this ship. Even if the episode is bad, if you have a little heartfelt, whatever, I'm down. Clay likes a high concept. Wes is all about a good title.
That's right.
Tana, what's the thing for you?
I love the character moments. I love, I really enjoy. It shocked me when you guys said that the show felt cold and that they are more colleagues. And I knew immediately what you were talking about, and I wondered why I never saw it like that. And I think it's because I was so young when I first watched the series, and I invested some part of myself in being on that ship, that I really clung to all of the interpersonal stuff that happens, the weird conversation about beards, or, you know, those little, there was a tea moment in one of these two episodes, I think, in a recent episode, and like they make each other try tea, or Picard drinks whiskey with Scotty. Like, I love that stuff so much, and so I would
so
have to
far
say,
in between though, that stuff is so rare for me anyway. Whenever this it happens, I'm like, yes, they're human.
Me and Clay have talked about this. I think I've probably talked about it with other people. There's a thing where when you become like very familiar with a subject, right? Like, say you're like big into Star Wars, or you're big into something else. Your mind starts making connections that aren't truly there in the source material. And going through these episodes has been really enlightening to me. Like, you know, just like when I was thinking before this rewatch, is like, Picard is definitely heavily involved in at least 50% of the episodes. That's just not true. That's not the way, the show is. But in my mind, I see that. In my mind, I see a closer relationship between these characters than what is always portrayed on screen.
Yep.
And so you start to, you just have to, I guess you just have to be careful. Not that it's wrong, but you just have to be careful, I guess, about recognizing what the episodes are actually doing. And the only way to absorb it, unfortunately, is to watch all 178 episodes, which not a lot of people have time for. But it's eye-opening to see it. It was the same when we watched Star Wars all the way through. You just have stuff in your mind that isn't actually there.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And you guys are going to laugh at me for not remembering. The guy that does the voice of Darth Vader, what is his name?
Earl Jones, right?
James Earl Jones. He says when fans come up to him in conventions and ask him to say, "Luke, I am your father," he corrects them because that's not what the line is.
And he's a huge dick.
Yeah, and he's like, "Actually, it's, whatever the actual line is. I apologize that I don't know it off the top of my hand." And then he tweeted something that like, "And then I choke them to death with the force," And it's really funny, but that's become Luke, I am your father has become what we think of culturally as the line. And it isn't. It's an invention. It's a fan invention.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I think that ties into the episodes that I really enjoy of this show are the ones that suit the cast, which in my mind are the kind of mystery we have a problem to solve episodes because the characters are basically the different personas of one well-balanced psyche. So if they're all working together, it's kind of a satisfying thing to see them not in conflict solve a problem. When they start to have family stuff, it starts to fall apart a little bit because the show, there are better shows for that kind of material.
But like the episode where Picard goes home to France and he's with his brother and his French, like futuristic French family. I loved that episode. That's one of my favorites. And that's a family one that doesn't take place on the ship. So I think they get it right sometimes.
They hit it. It's just not a. They're not built in the same way that the TOS crew was assembled, and there's a difference in why the T. I think it ties into why the TNG movies are not as good as the TOS movies.
The movies. Are you reviewing the movies at some point, Wes?
Yeah, we'll do the movies when this is over. I mean, it's grading on a curve with the TNG movies, but I mean, it's just. Yeah, we'll be interesting when we get there. But anyway, did you guys have any other thoughts for Ship in a Bottle before we wrap this thing up?
We were talking about punishing Moriarty, and one thought did occur. And so it feels like it kind of sucks because he held the ship hostage and he kind of got away with it. He'll never have to feel the repercussions of what he did. And somebody raised a question of is it more important to punish someone or just to get rid of the problem? And I think about, modern terrorism or whatever, things that we don't like in our society. I would rather just beam them onto another planet and have them never know about it than actually spend tax dollars and imprisoning them and make them feel bad.
No, I mean, my personal philosophy is the punishment is not part of the justice system. There, like, it's, I feel the same way about, I have this weird thing, no one ever seems to agree with me, where I don't care about people apologizing to me. Like, unless apologies only to me make sense when you accidentally do something. Like, if you come into my house and you break something accidentally and you're like, oh, geez, I'm sorry. It's like, oh, no big deal. If you intentionally wrong me and then you try to apologize, the apology isn't really mean anything. It's really just for it's for like me to feel better, but it doesn't fix anything.
I'm with you on this. I'm with you on this. And my girlfriend is big into apologies. Like, she needs to hear them. She needs you to mean them, And I don't like if something goes wrong, I really don't give a fuck about apologies. Like, we make it better. We fix it and we don't do it again. Like, it's very simple, but there's a lot of emphasis. Certain people are very much into like apologize for what you've done.
And
And I just don't.
it's big in the political sphere. It's like if someone says something fucking stupid, everyone's up in arms about he needs to apologize. It's like he doesn't need to apologize. The apology is not going to fix A, the state of the world, and B, the fact that he said this at some point. Like who cares?
I think public, I don't know. We don't have shame anymore publicly. Like, people don't feel, it seems to me, responsibility for their actions. So I can understand a public apology more than my own private need for a human to human apology. I think that there's a time and a place for everything.
Well,
But,
I guess it ties. I guess it ties into the function of the apology, right? The function of the apology is to make the person who perceives something has been wrong with them to make them feel better. Someone saying something online should have no impact on you as a person. Like, so why do they need to apologize to you? It's your fault that you're getting upset by what they said.
Well, what if they threaten them? What if they threaten to murder their family, let's say?
Well, that's different because they're actively. I'm talking about if someone says something stupid, and you go and someone says this is upsetting that someone would say something like this. It's like, yes, I mean they're stupid for saying it, but it doesn't have any impact on you, outside of your own sense of this upsets me, and therefore I deserve an apology, which doesn't make any sense to me.
I feel like apologies show self-awareness too. Yeah. I mean, if someone's so in their own head and they don't even see that they ruffle feathers, that flags someone that I don't want to hang around with. If someone can apologize, and that shows that they're self-aware, that they know that they have things they're working on. And I think that's a psychological strength. They have that ability.
Yes, I'd agree with that.
And I also think, Wes, that this might be, as a woman who spends some time doing podcasts and putting her artwork out into the world, like the internet is different for women, and you're going to get threats. You're going to get rape threats and threats against your life. And I think owning that sort of behavior and recognizing publicly that it's not cool for you to say shit like that on Twitter or online is important. I think that there's a place for that.
But that has nothing to do with an apology.
Right, but I recognize that's not actually what we're talking about here.
Like I'm not pro people being douchebags to each other, but what I'm saying is that the apology, if someone gave me a death threat and then apologized on Twitter, I would say your apology doesn't mean shit. Like I don't understand why you would try to apologize.
Right, you can stick the apology where the sun don't shine.
Right.
But I think action matters, right? Like this is, I don't know. I'm with you.
sorry you even broached this subject. I think it's fascinating. It just ties into like punishing Moriarty at the end of the episode. My sense of the world is I am pro removing threats or danger over punishing.
Yeah,
and my done bad actions.
I was when I was watching the episode, and I'm trying to put myself in that position. Like I'm, you know, an officer on the Enterprise, and this guy has commandeered our vehicle and threatened the lives of every living person on the ship unless he gets his way, then I would have taken an angle of, you are behaving as a hostile entity, you know, you're making threats, it's not okay, well, I'm going to give in to the demands of a terrorist. And I think as an acting officer, you know, I would have made different decisions than what Riker had made in the way that they approached their interactions. But I don't know that there's a way forward there. You know, they weren't going to get Picard back that way.
Well, let's
that was something that took me out of the episode.
I'm gonna close this with a thought process. So say we get the chance to punish Moriarty, right? In his little, he's in his cube, like sailing the seven seas. So the options here for the crime of commandeering the Enterprise, he's going to live what we consider to be a normal human lifespan. However old he is now, like mid 50s or however old that actor is at the time, he's going to live a normal 80 to 90 year lifespan for a human. So we're going to punish him. Are we going to, would you rather give him 2 years of a jail cell, or would you rather have him live his entire life having minor nuisances happen more than like average person?
Like erectile dysfunction every time he tries to bang his lady.
Right. Or like when he goes to buy something, everything costs like $1.01, so he gets 99 cents back. Like something really stupid. Like it's just like, oh, Jesus. Like this is what
the weirdest discussion of punishment I've ever been included in.
Well, which one would you rather have?
He's not real, so you could just. I would rather.
He's sentient, though. We've decided he's sentient.
I would rather delete his program painlessly as crushing an ant, right? Than allow this man to continue, because you know. And I think honestly, I think that the end of the episode is perfectly fine. I think it's a nice thought experiment. You know, he lives out a human life. He goes on great adventures. I think that's a perfectly reasonable end of the episode.
Yep.
But to play in this sandbox, crush the cube, delete his program, boom, you're out.
So you think killing an ant is worse than killing Moriarty in this episode?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think that killing an ant, putting a lobster in a pot, would those both outrank the happiness of the computer program that has threatened the lives of a thousand
people. You're not killing him because he's computer sentient. You're killing him because he's a criminal who put a lot of people at risk.
Yes.
Okay.
For me, there's a difference there. And I agree.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I disagree on both counts. But anyway, we're going to go to...
It's a good thing I'm not in charge of these things.
If we have a discussion about how would you punish characters, I would love to start with Wesley next time.
I mean, Yeah, he's I'll say this before we flip it to final thoughts. I think his Moriarty in this episode is a higher creature than a lesser creature would be. Like Moriarty is basically a person who exists in a computer program to me.
I agree with you, Wes. Yeah, if I didn't make that clear, I absolutely agree with that.
Okay. So anyway, final
To me,
thoughts.
he's just ones and zeros.
Right.
Yeah.
I would rather have Siri survive out of my iPhone. We are going to go to final thoughts and ratings for Ship in a Bottle right after this break.
We're still on the holodeck.
How do you know that?
Through deduction, sir. Lieutenant Barclay and I tried to transport a simulated object off the holodeck, something that has never been attempted. Since the transporter itself is a simulation, the computer had no real data from which to create the transport logs.
Maybe it was just a malfunction in the transporter.
Then I saw you working the pad with your left hand. Commander LaForge is right-handed, sir. A similar malfunction occurred in the Sherlock Holmes program I was running before Moriarty first appeared.
Mr. Data, if what you say is true, then this is not Geordi LaForge. You certain?
And we're back with Ship in a Bottle. It was a good discussion. I enjoyed this one.
That
I
was
think
good.
I think that's why it's a good episode, because when I watch truly bad episodes, I end up sitting with the people going, "Well, what'd you think
right.
about that time Riker took the shuttlecraft out?" And they're like, "Well, it was whatever." And it's like, "Good."
Without this episode, I never would have known that you despise lobsters and bees so much, Wesley.
I don't even eat them. I just throw them in the pot and throw them out the outside.
you just boil them to destroy them.
Yeah, like when the settlers arrived in Maine and they gave prisoners so much lobster that they made a law that you can't eat lobster if you're in jail. That's just cooking lobster endlessly. Yeah, that's it. That's my thoughts on my poorly conceived thoughts about sentience and suffering and everything like that.
Yeah, it was
so
a good discussion.
Let's talk about Ship in a Bottle's final ratings. It was a good discussion. So I can't remember who went last, last time in the quality of life. So does the other person want to go first with their thoughts about Ship in a Bottle?
Sean, you go.
Tennis. All right. I think, like I said, everything I like about it. I would give it a 5, but I'd go low 5. Like if there's a top 10 for me, this would be 12. Just
okay.
just below, because
yep.
I agree with a lot of the technical things that Tana pointed out.
Cool. Tana?
This one is a 1 for me. Maybe a low 2, but I would not. Maybe I would watch it. You know what? I might watch it after our discussion to try to see the goodness in it that you guys saw.
Were you aware of the plot the first time when you watched it this first time?
No,
okay.
I was not aware of the plot. I've seen this episode. I completely forgot it. And I would have skipped it after the opening scene if we weren't podcasting about it, because
yeah,
it is such a ridiculous as soon as he walks out of the holodeck,
yep.
I was like, oh, this is ridiculous. And then they're talking to him about the options. And I'm like, it could never happen.
I'm not accusing you of I'm not saying you must pay attention. Do you think that you stopped paying as close of attention after that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So I should go back
Is
and
that,
rewatch it.
Something
and...
that I feel like Tana should apologize for that.
Yeah,
right now.
I think you should write a letter too.
I'm going to give you my heartfelt apology for not paying closer attention to this episode.
You intentionally came into my house.
I didn't want to cause you any suffering.
I know.
Well, unless a lobster wrote this, you'd have to apologize, I suppose. But Yeah, I'll give it a 4, I think. I really like this episode. It's much better than I remembered. Mostly, I think the first Moriarty episode is not quite as good, and I think I confused them in my mind a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy this one. I think it's well written, which is nice to see. It's not the middling TNG episode where the format and the structure is always the same, and I'm so bored of that at this point.
Right.
This is a well-written, well-structured thing. Great acting and kind of a cool concept behind what they're going on. It has, and I love the ending. I love the wink at the camera. I love Barclay asking the computer to shut down, and then being relieved when it doesn't shut down. And
yeah.
I just think it's kind of a cute little episode.
Yeah,
guys, thank you very much for coming on.
Good talk,
Thanks
guys.
So much for having us.
It was a good talk. It was excellent. And if you guys are on YouTube, like in the comments, appreciate it. If you enjoyed the content, that is. If you're on iTunes, Rating and review helps get the show out there. If you're on Patreon and you want to support the show with a couple of Patreon bucks a month, go to patreon.com/thepenskypodcast, facebook.com/thepenskypodcast. All this fucking housekeeping. When I started the podcast, there was no housekeeping. What have I become? Go to facebook.com/thepenskypodcast and leave a like and a comment there. Guys, thank you very much for listening. I greatly appreciate it. We're flying through season 6. Sean and Tana, thank you very much again for coming
on. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good discussion. And so I'm going to wrap this one up. I'm going to throw this into a pot of boiling water and call it a day. That's it for discussion about shipping a bottle. See ya.